I'm Rufus Norris. This is Spieling the Beans, and I've just been having a wonderful chat with Dom Stevens, who's asked the most erudite and challenging questions. Hope you enjoy it.
Hello and welcome to Spieling the Beans with me, Dom Stevens, the storytelling podcast in which storytellers tell stories about telling stories. My guest today is a multi-award-winning theatre and film director whose appearance on this show has been a long time coming. We first met and spoke about him coming on the podcast in April 2024 at the press night for the play Underdog the Other Bronte. And a couple of weeks ago, we finally sat down, me in London, him in Scotland, to record his episode. You see, he has until recently been a little bit busy running the National Theatre. He first rose to prominence in 2001 when he won the career-making Evening Standard Award for Outstanding Newcomer for his production of David Rudkin's A Four-Night Come at the Young Vic. Since then, he's added nominations and statues for just about every theatre award going, most recently the Society of London Theatre Special Award and a knighthood, both for his services to theatre. And alongside his dozens of theatre shows, he's directed three acclaimed films. His 2012 feature, Broken, premiered at Cannes and received the Best British Independent Film Award at the British Independent Film Awards. And then in 2015, he took over from Sir Nicholas Heitner as the sixth artistic director of the National Theatre, and the first since Laurence Olivier not to have attended Cambridge University. He ran the building, which comprises of the Olivier, Littleton and Dorfman stages, for a decade, stepping down earlier this year. His tenure spanned Brexit, Grenfell, COVID, six prime ministers and 11 culture ministers. And over the course of it, through his curation and creation, he enabled the world to have such shows as Dear England, The Motive and the Cue, Small Island, Hex, Mosquitoes, London Road, the Andrew Garfield and Nathan Lane revival of Angels in America, the Ivan Van Hove Bryan Cranston Network, the Layman Trilogy, Hadestown, Ballet Shoes, the Max Webster Importance of Being Earnest, the Lindsay Turner productions of The Witches and Coriolanus, Sondheim's final work Here We Are, Duncan Macmillan and Jeremy Herrin's People, Places and Things, and the Michael Sheen starring Nye, to name just a few. Over the course of these 90 minutes in one of the longest episodes we've ever done on Spieling the Beans, we cover the artistic benefits of shyness, how to run one of the most renowned cultural institutions on earth, the difference between a theatre director and a film director, and kayaking, among so much more. So, please welcome my guest for this episode, Sir Rufus Norris. Rufus, thank you so much for doing this.
No, pleasure, pleasure, and it's been great to have a listen to some of the others.
Oh yeah,
yeah, frightening, these eloquent people that you talk to.
Who have you listened to?
Rupert and Simon, I suppose, particularly because they're in a way closest to what I do, and I know them both quite well. So,
sure.
Yeah.
Great. Well, you have a mantra: run towards things that scare you. How did that come about?
How did it come about? Wow. I don't know. I mean, I suppose I'm very fortunate in that I come from a large family, a large close family. And so I suppose the bedrock of profound security is profound. In the simplest terms, I know that I'm loved. So a lot of things which for many people stimulate fear are to do with a lack of sort of core security, which I've been incredibly fortunate that I've had. And I also, for better or worse, grew up all over the world, which meant that my childhood was filled with, and also to do with the nature of how my parents, my mum in particular, dealt with this tribe. I've got five siblings, so there were six of us, and we're all quite close in age, how much freedom we had, which meant that you know, we had a lot of adventures, some of them organised and some of them, you know, off our own volition. And that bred in me a kind of a wonder, I guess, at what the world contained, the wide world. And also a sense that, if things go really badly, unless you're very unlucky, they don't go that badly. You might, pick up a disease or fall over or get into a sticky situation, but you'll probably come through it. And when you do, you'll be loved, or forgiven, or looked after. Going on from there, taking it into a kind of professional realm, I suppose, it equipped me with a sense that the worst is not that bad. And I think I'm quite I'm a bit of an introvert, really. I'm quite I find myself in my natural state not that interesting. And I'm at my best when I'm alive, when I'm in the moment. And you tend to be in the moment more when you're in a situation that is uncertain. So, I guess through a lot of my work, I've tried to put myself in that situation because I feel more alive. I'm my best self when I'm completely engaged.
Well, that's first of all really a really beautiful way to begin and to know you have that sort of solidity, that sort of concrete base, and then things sort of like a reviewer might not say something you'd ideally like is way beyond that base level of security and sort of and comfort there. You've described yourself before as both shy and very emotionally robust, and I was wondering how those two things coalesced, but I guess in that sort of way that you've just described.
Yeah, I think and that's where the introversion comes in. No, just as you've said, the bottom line is so far, touch wood, secure. And I've been very lucky. I've had my share of grief or tricky situations, or life does what it does, but so far, unexpected tragedy has not touched me particularly. So I've been fortunate. It's always dangerous, isn't it? If you say, "Oh, I'm emotionally robust," it's like putting a target on your
A
chest.
little bit.
Saying, come on, give it to me, and I don't want to tempt that.
Yes, a sort of yelling come at me to a dramatic sky.
Yeah.
Well, on introversion then, because I similarly sort of grew up sort of shy and introverted, and I feel like I've become less so, but there's still an aspect there. Do you feel like shyness or introversion can be an asset to a director?
I think so. I think it has been for me because it gives you a little distance, and distance is necessary in that job. I trained as an actor and worked as an actor for a short while. I think I always knew it wasn't going to be my thing, but certainly the process of standing back from a story and looking at the whole picture can suit that introversion, where whatever's going on in your head is not necessarily coming out of your mouth all the time, and it gives you an ability to make decisions, perhaps see a bigger picture, which is part of the job.
Yeah, I remember you saying a story of the acting work you did at the theatre you helped build, as in physically you helped put up walls in, and the note you got from the director, you being crucified on stage. The director noted that you were sort of too aware of the general large picture as opposed to your specific role.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It was in a fringe theatre called Arts Threshold, and the guy who ran it was a guy called Brian Asprey, who really was the sort of primary mentor, I suppose, for me. Who is an extraordinary South African guy, who had come over, like many white South Africans, in the sort of particular phase of the dark days of apartheid, with his wife Yvonne Briceland, who is a very celebrated actor, and he had started teaching in drama schools, and he was quite an obdurate, stubborn opinionated but very, very principled person. And he encouraged students to get off their ass and make work themselves. And I fell in with that crowd. They were mainly centered around students from Lambda, but I found out about it through another director, Helena Kauthausen, and went along, and it sort of became, yeah, sort of became a home in a way. And Brian at that stage and the Arts Threshold crew had managed to find a basement in Paddington, and they did that up to have a base. And because I had a background in the building trade, I don't know, maybe Brian genuinely wanted me to be in his show, but I think there was a dual incentive there. So anyway, I helped them kit it out, and I was in one of the first shows. I wasn't very good in it. It wasn't very good. It was overlong, and I was far more interested in the cuts that were necessary and the shaping of the whole. And he quite rightly pointed out that perhaps acting wasn't for me.
Sure. Well, then, what was the first show where you felt like, not necessarily the first show you directed, but the first one you felt like, oh, I could do this. I'm quite good at this. This is a thing that I could really sort of dedicate a lot of time to.
I was extremely fortunate in that it happened immediately.
Okay.
So while I was doing that play at Arts Threshold, I was also at the time juggling various little acting jobs with writing music. Music was a big part of my upbringing and life before then. And I had a little studio and was with a friend of mine. We were writing, music for dance and fringe theatre and that kind of thing, and I'd been to see him, and his partner at the time had written, well, his partner now had written an adaptation of a short story by Angela Carter, and she asked me to take it home to Tanya, my partner, and I read it on the tube, and I got off the tube at the other end. And just sat on the tube platform until I'd finished it because I was completely compelled with it. I took it into Arts Threshold the next day and suggested to Brian that we put it on and maybe I could play this part or maybe I could write the music for it. And he said, no, why don't you have a go at it yourself? And so I did a little workshop on it, which was the way that things got past the kind of vetting process there. We got past that process and we programmed it, and it really was the first day of rehearsal when we went in. And of course, I'd done a lot of prep and was determined to not make a fool of myself. And because Arts Threshold was an ensemble, really, all the people who were in it, or most of them, were already friends with people that I'd acted with, or run the cafe with, or done the box office with, or cleaned the floors with, or built that place with. So there was already a very strong ensemble feeling, and yeah, it was just a fantastic first day. And I went home going, right, that's it. That's what I'm doing now.
Amazing. It's interesting that it was an adaptation because one of the first things you did when you moved to the National was work with Carolyn Duffy on Everyman. Was that a conscious choice of the first thing I did was an adaptation, and that went well, and I now need to seemingly quite heavily convince Carolyn Duffy to take on a quick turnaround big projects like Everyman.
No, not really. I mean, I think when you're running an organization that has theaters in it with the number of seats that the National does, adaptation is always going to be part of the mix. And we've done many over my time there, and a lot of them have been very successful. They're a canny way to spear the big story, the contemporary story, and the often a title, where like Small Island, for example, or Ballyshoes, which is on at the moment, where you can draw the eye of your potential audience. With Everyman, it was completely different. I had been working up a new play for the opening. I wanted to start with something which was going to lay out the the sort of foundation, I suppose, of what I thought the National might be about during that time. And for various reasons, which I won't go into, that didn't pan out. And it was quite late before it was clear that it wasn't going to pan out. And I think it was probably 3 or 4 months before rehearsal started that I found myself with no show to open the season, which obviously was not an ideal situation. But it's interesting that going back to the point of step into the fear, it also made me feel comfortable. I thought, okay, right, now you're up against it. Crack on with it. I had a slightly complicated transition process from when I was given the job to when my program actually started in lots of different ways, but it was compounded by the fact that I had a very full freelance diary at the time. I was making a film, Film of London Road, in fact, and I was also doing Behind Beautiful Forevers at the National. So I had not done enough. I suppose I had not done enough prep to be ready for the, I didn't have a plan B, plan C. So I went to my little formative group of associates at the time, Marianne Elliott, Dom Cook, Ben Power, and Lindsay Turner. And Lindsay, and we discussed hundreds of plays, and Lindsay said, look, you were drawn to Everyman. Why don't you have a crack at that? Everyman in its extant form, the form that we've got, it's anonymous, it needs a radical take, let's say. And so I dived into it and thought, well, there's only one, I certainly, if I can, want to start with a female playwright. And I didn't know Carol-Anne at all, but I did know her work, particularly from my time at the Young Vic. And so on a kind of, an instinct, I just reached out to her, and thank God she came back. And I think some of our emails have been published, but she was, we hit a humor, a common humor immediately. And we took it from there. Yeah, when we started rehearsals, I think 8 pages of what became a kind of 50-page script were written. Most of it was written in the room on the actors that we were making it with, which was, very exciting. And fortunately, it came off.
Yeah, it absolutely did. And not only, yes, the emails have been published now, I've been able to read them in prep for this. And another one which fits in well is something that Tom Hughes wrote to Simon Stevens when you're working on the, I never, is it Threepenny or Threepney? How do you say it?
Threepney.
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 Threepney Opera. Tom wrote that something I like about working with Rufus, there is so little bullshit and social decorum, it's like he's ignored every seminar on working with actors and writers that I've ever been to. How do you run a room then? What's a Rufus Norris room like?
I don't know. I don't know. It's interesting, isn't it? Kind of like, what's your technique? Obviously, there's, the main thing. I think I meant to ask you, actually, are you allowed to swear on this podcast?
Yes, feel free.
I'm not that I particularly want to. It's just whether I should be, minding my P's and Q's. I suppose the first principle is don't work with wankers. Make sure you've got make sure you've got good people in the room. And I try to ensure that I've got a mix. And there's no sort of binary, but ideally you're sort of working around a kind of 50-50, both in the creative team and the cast, of people who've worked with me before and people who haven't, so that you're not getting into a kind of director's mates world. But at the same time, you've got people in there who can set the tone, because things are going to get sticky. I like to discover as things go on, and I'm a great believer in the power of the ensemble. So there's no point working with a bunch of brilliant people if you're not going to give them their head and use the ideas that are coming out of them. Inevitably, you can yeah, you can I think the you know, it's a cliche, but the you know, the combination of the whole is more than the sum of its parts, all the rest of it. And I totally hold by that. I often, you know, I often will prepare quite thoroughly. I'll draw my way through shows, and depending on the designer that I'm working with, there'll often be a lot of drawing that goes into that. So I'll have a starting idea, but in an ideal world, none of those will end up being what happens on stage, because you find it with the, you know, with the combined brilliance of the people that you're working with. So creating an environment where that is likely to happen, where people feel empowered. You know, acting, I know, is it, it's it requires a vulnerability. You've got to make a fool of yourself. You've got to stand up and be vulnerable. So creating an environment where people know they're safe to do that, and that they will be listened to, that good ideas will not only be picked up on, but also be credited. I think a director's job is to direct, to make decisions. They don't have to be your ideas. Nobody likes working in a situation where there are no decisions being made. And sometimes you have to go, no, we're going to go with my idea, or we can, you know, we're going to, yeah, thank you, but we're going to move on. But when ideas come up, and they always do pretty early, from other people, by demonstrating that you are listening, you're open to stuff, it helps everybody, I think, helps everybody relax and feel like they can be themselves. Obviously, beyond that, there's other stuff, you know, look after people. When Tom's talking about, you know, not watching any seminar, he's saying it with a light heart. You know, I don't bully. I do respect the people that I work with, and if there's a robust sense of humor or a kind of vigor about the work, it's done from a foundation of care.
Absolutely, and that seems to be, it keeps coming up and again and again when I read how people sort of describe working with you and being in those spaces. On imagery, you're talking about drawing your way through shows. In Nye, which is I think one of my favourite shows that you've directed, there was when I saw it in its first run, the image that sort of stuck with me the most was when the teacher, when Nye is about sort of 5 or 6 years old and he's suffering with the stutter. And he's being caned when he's not able to recite the poem that's being asked of him. The two long canes that the teacher has transforms him into this sort of spider-like monster. At what point did that do you remember the creation of that scene, that imagery? And if so, how did that sort of that visual or those visuals more widely come to be?
If I can just pull out a little bit, I think that the crucial, or the sort of central word in how we created Nye was a word which is applied to the sound world, I think, which is diegetic. As I understand it, this will be a simplistic version. If you're watching a piece of theatre, if the sound is diegetic, it is the sound which is being made in the room. So if somebody's playing a guitar in the corner, then that is diegetic. If you're bringing in a string section to make the audience feel that the scene is moving, that is non-diegetic. Film is, you know, almost exclusively non-diegetic, and because of the way that we receive film, that's completely fine. In theatre, it's more complex, and I prefer sound to be diegetic, and if not purely diegetic, I prefer it to come from the world. So you've got a principle of form from content, which is something that I try to bear in mind, whatever I'm doing. That what how does the content of this piece, why you're doing it, why you personally are doing it, how does that lead to the how you're going to do it, if that makes sense. And because what Tim Price had written from the first draft onwards was a fantasia, a Welsh fantasia, as he described it, it was extraordinary, and he'd never held back from He never tried to answer how the production was going to be made manifest. He just let himself go free. And because, Nye was in a the concept of Nye being unconscious or in a dream world was there from the first draft. That was very it was extraordinary what Tim, the provocations, the directorial and design provocations that Tim wrote into the different drafts were florid, to put it mildly. So when Vicky Mortimer and I sat down to work out how the hell we were going to kind of corral this into something that was both achievable and also coherent, we settled on this concept of the diegetic and tried to apply it to everything. So in the play, Nye is in a hospital ward. He comes round from an exploratory operation that was intended to look at his stomach ulcer. They opened him up and found that, in fact, it was much worse than that. And in the play, this isn't quite what happened in real life, but in the play, he has a very painful attack, and they put him under morphine, and he remains in that state until he dies. In reality, it took him several months, actually, and he didn't die in hospital. But Tim wanted to compress it down and kept it within that period. So in a sense, the whole play takes place in an NHS hospital ward in the early 60s, which is, of course, wonderful in two ways. One is it's the NHS that Nye is famous for creating, and two, it gave Vicky and I a really coherent sort of foundation for how to build from that. So then we sort of made the rule, okay, everything has to come out of that hospital ward. So everything you see in the play has to be referenced in the 2 or 3 minutes where Nye is conscious, because everything that he takes in that period when he's looking around the ward or what's around him will feed his fantasia, in the same way that if you might have a I might have had a dream last night where I, met my uncle. He was a dog, but he was my uncle. You know how dreams go. And of course, that will be related to the dog that I had a altercation with, or a friendly meeting with sometime yesterday afternoon, or whatever. These things, the dreams are a way of us working through what's happened in the relatively recent past. And I don't expect or mind whether an audience understood that, whether all those references, and you'd probably have to watch it 10 times to see the degree to which we obeyed that. The important thing is that it gave Vicky and I, and then the video designer and the sound designer and everybody else, a grounding, a way to deliver what Tim was writing. It sort of gave it a discipline. And I do think that, restriction is your sort of best friend in making theatre. Even at the National, where where you have a wealth of technical facility at your disposal. So that was the sort of foundation of it. In terms of Mr. Orchard, the teacher, what we knew is that Nye, at that stage was young, was sort of 7 or 8 years old. In school, we wanted to somehow deliver that on stage. And so, of course, the first thought is, we'll just find a really tall actor who's going to play Orchard. Because of I've got to be careful here because I don't really know what I'm talking about, but because of the environment that many Welsh people, particularly working class Welsh people from South Wales and the valleys, have suffered or experienced over the last few hundred years, there aren't that many very tall Welsh people from South Wales. It doesn't go with mining. It doesn't go with a lot of the work that you had to do to thrive. And it became clear that was a casting restriction that was, not something that was going to help us. And anyway, let's be a bit more imaginative about it. I decided that he should be on stilts to achieve this. And Vicky, kind of in her brilliant way, shrugged that off and said, "Come on, that's not, what we do. We're doing a circus here, are we? How diegetic is that?" So it went on from there. So we thought, well, what's the guy doing in the? He's got to have a cane. What is in this first in this first glimpse of the NHS ward that will give us the opportunity? And that's when the sort of why treats the how. If you're going to, if it's all got to be in this ward, how's that going to help you? And we very rapidly came up with, okay, there's a man on the ward who's using walking sticks. He's recovering from some kind of injury to his leg. And if you scan back, you'll notice that that man is in a prominent position as Nye is scanning the ward at the beginning. Again, I don't expect an audience necessarily to get that consciously, but subconsciously, I think it goes in. And then, you work through and go, okay, well, we're not going to extend his legs. We can get him to stand on a chair, but we can extend the canes. And then Jess Williams and Stephen Hoggart come in, who are fantastic collaborators and completely got the whole language of it. And they give him height by lifting him up and moving him around. And so it's a principle that we then obey through the kind of controlling rules of the production.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And as you were saying that, I was replaying images from the play in my head, because I noticed it's impossible not to notice the use of the NHS sort of green curtains, beds, things like that. There's a bit where he's standing at either on like a jury bench or a podium or something, and it's the bed that's lifted up. But I hadn't clocked, as you say, I've seen it fewer than 10 times so far, so I didn't clocked it of that they're all sort of there and like that was it a sort of seeded at the start to then go into those places. But yes.
Well, it's good that you didn't.
Sure.
That's not, who wants an audience to be sitting back and analyzing? Oh, well, that's very clever the way that they've done that. Well, that isn't very. That doesn't. The most important thing is that you're drawn into it, and you forget about that, and you're just taken with the story. But hopefully, what it does is it. I mean, apart from helping you as the makers make decisions. It means that there's an inevitability, in terms of the kind of doubling. You go, well, what? How are we going to make this really clear from the beginning? And of course, the first transformation, the immediate transformation, is from the nurse to his sister. You have a different actor appearing, but by going, no, it's going to be the same actor and an actor that could not possibly be his biological sister. You say to the audience, this is a world in which, and then what happens is that that nurse has a resonance for both Nye and for the audience that plays out through the rest of the production. When Churchill appears, which happens quite late, it again makes complete sense that it's the doctor that he's met early on, and then towards the end of the play, when Tony Jawadne is shifting quickly between Churchill and Dr. Dane, again, there's a lovely theatrical kind of poignancy in that. It also enables you to seed other subtleties, which are, these things. Again, I don't. It doesn't matter if the audience receives them consciously, but they make it very enriching to work on. When you think, well, Nye Bevan had a great relationship. Sorry, brain fog. That's the problem with being with Nehru, the first Prime Minister of India. And Churchill was not beloved by the Indian nation for reasons which history will bear out. So. And also, the NHS was, of course, had a challenge at the beginning in recruitment. So there were doctors that came from the Indian subcontinent who were in that early recruitment in the NHS. So to have an actor of Indian heritage or Sri Lankan heritage, playing Churchill, was it, where it has its own, has its own timbre, and something which was not at all lost on Tony, when I, met him and offered him the part, he was, he kind of couldn't say no, because when is somebody, of his heritage gonna get that poignant chance to rewrite a little bit of history?
Yeah, completely. You're clearly an incredibly collaborative practitioner, and you've spoken before about the importance of assisting Stephen Daldry. Was that something you picked up from his process, or what did you sort of, how did he most influence your style of directing and others you've assisted along the way?
Yeah, I mean, I've assisted a few people. I would say that Stephen was the most, he was the person that I assisted the most, but he was also the most impactful in that way. He just goes back to that thing. He simply doesn't care where the idea comes from, and he will interrogate. He'll pull on the piece of string until there's, until it's fully pulled out. So we might be talking about. It could be anything. The first thing I assisted him on was a short play by Carol Churchill called "This Is a Chair," at the Royal Court, when we were decamped to the West End when it was being renovated, and Ian Rickson actually had said to me, "You need to, while you're here." I was there for a year on a assistant director scheme. Ian said, "You should try and assist Stephen while you're here," and so I plucked up the courage to go and ask him if I could assist him on the Carol Churchill that I knew he was going to do, and he said no, and I was slightly put out, and he said, "Why? Why should I?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, because I want you to." And he said, "Well, how am I going to do it?" And I was completely flummoxed, and said, "I don't know. I don't know. It's curious, isn't it? There's all these different scenes, and I wonder what the thread is that ties them together." And he said, "Yes, what is it?" And I said, I don't know, but there's one song that I that, there's a song that I that keeps coming into my head." And he said, "What is it?" And I said, it's obscure. It's got nothing to do with the play, and it's called "Dancing at the Funeral Party" by The Cure." And he said, "Sing it." Go, what? So literally on the roof of the Ambassador's Theatre, I kind of did a crap version of a Cure song, which lost everything in translation, and I hardly started. He went, "All right, yeah, okay, you can do it." And what I hadn't realised is that what I'd done for him is just got him thinking about the play in a different way. He didn't take my note. But he used it as a springboard for something else, and that happened repeatedly. When we were working on Via Dolorosa, the one man play about Israel and Palestine that David Hare wrote and performed in, it was literally four of us in the room, David, Stephen, myself, and the stage manager, for weeks as we went through the quite thorny challenge of how to unlock this and how to give David the foundation to be able to do something which he didn't normally do, and there'd be hours of me sitting there not saying anything and watching, at one stage I remember Stephen turning to me because there was a particular knotty problem, and he said, "How am I going to do this?" And I, my head had gone. I was miles away. I hadn't been concentrating for the last half hour or whatever. And I had nothing to say. I didn't even know where we were in the play. I was not doing my job. I said, don't know. And he went, okay. And then, just carried on. And I thought, that is not going to happen again. And so, because, normally as an assistant, you never get asked that. But with Stephen, you just never know where he's going to go. Right, I need something. So the next time he did, a few days later, I had an answer. And he went, no, something else. I gave him another option. No, something else. Okay, what do you mean? Da, 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 da. And then he'd pull on whatever piece of string I was offering, because by then I already had kind of three or four different ways of solving whatever, and in my brilliance, I knew exactly how to, which of course, wouldn't have borne out and certainly wouldn't have gone down well with David. But it was, yeah, it was really informative just how uninhibited an artist hears, and that lack of inhibition means that you take the idea from wherever it's coming from. You really don't need to worry about whose it is. And then, over the next couple of things we did together, because I was always ready, he used me a bit more, and occasionally would even leave the room and just leave me to it. Yeah, I think that's the thing. It's the lack of inhibition about where the idea comes from.
Yeah, there's I know Rory Kinnear, and I think Olivia Colman has also said it, that you're the first director they've encountered who said, "I don't know," in response to a question, and to find that liberating as an actor, sort of, oh, I can offer ideas or I can offer suggestions, which still seems relatively rare, but it does seem only the right way. If your view is the end product, the end show, it seems silly to sort of restrict yourself to an auteur kind of. Everything must come from me. No one else can offer.
I really don't think there's a right or a wrong way. I've seen many productions where there clearly is a very, very strong defining vision that has come from the beginning, and some of them have been brilliant. There's no I think that one of the joys of it as a job, and certainly one of the joys of theatre generally, is that it's an incredibly broad church. That it works for me, and it certainly makes for a team spirit, a collaborative spirit. And when the going gets tough, which I'm afraid it always does on all the shows I've ever made, you have everybody with you. Because I think that's what, that's one thing that I, and it probably is a fault. The way we make theatre is that the writer can have, 6 months or 10 years to write a play, and the director comes on board at a certain point and either works dramaturgically with them or just delivers what they've written. And again, there's not a right or wrong way. Though if you're doing the closer you get to something, it's a kind of slightly naff term, but the idea of a total theatre, the more it does need everybody to be pitching in. And that's the sort of theatre that I like making. And then you go into rehearsal and all the actors get involved. Sorry, you've got the whole design process, et cetera, et cetera. But we have years or months or weeks to prepare. When you get into tech, there are a whole other swathe of practitioners who've been around, but they have a great deal to offer as well. And it's only when you get in that kitchen that they can really do their stuff. So the lighting designer and the sound designer, if you still want them to have the flexibility to play, particularly on new work, and most of the work I've done has had the writer in the room, there's also things that you discover from the audience. The preview period is absolutely crucial. I've made really, really strong and radical changes in a preview period, and that's tough on the actors. It's really tough if they're delivering new script right up to press night, and everything's changing. You've got to have them with you, and you can't ask for that if you haven't earned it.
Yeah, no, completely. You mentioned a little bit before London Road and viewing that along with Broken. How Have you found the role of film director is different to role of theatre director?
Big question. I think it's completely different, and I can't really talk about it with a great deal of authority. I have made a couple of films. I made and some shorts and a 1 hour TV piece. So I'm sort of, the scales are balanced very heavily in the other direction. But it's very, very different. I think there still is a huge amount of collaboration in it, and you still want to create an environment where the magic can happen. The beautiful thing about film is you've only got to have it once, and you've got it. And the editing process is a beautiful process. If you've got the stuff, if you haven't, you're scrabbling around, and you really do need a great editor to get you out of all sorts of trouble. But to get that magic, you again, I think you need the way that I've found to do it anyway is you need people to have a little bit of elbow room to do their stuff, whether that's the DP or the actors, making sure that there's an awful lot of prep. It's a making the day is the you've got to make the day. That's you've got these shots that you've got to do in the day. That one and that one can fall off because you might be able to pick them up. That one and that one, in the end you can probably get around it if you don't capture them. But ideally, you're gonna make every shot and you're gonna get a load of other stuff while you're doing it. But the real joy is when you're again in that moment of feeling completely absorbed and completely alive, and the unexpected can happen, and the actor or the actors in that situation and the DP need to feel they've got a little bit of agency within that. If I think of both of those films, my favorite moments in both of them are the things that they might be exactly what the writer wrote, but then but they're it's a visual medium. But something has come up in the moment, which is there's a scene in Broken, which is probably my favorite scene, where it's a family drama, centers around an 11-year-old girl, and I was totally blessed in that we just had in Eloise Lawrence a gift of a young actor, and it's family scene where she's mucking about with her brother, with her dad in the background, and so I just sort of brought a few bits and pieces in to think, okay, what can I throw at them that they're not going to expect. And Bill Milner, who was playing the brother, again, very playful and really experienced already by then. I gave him a bag of pegs, and said, "Go and have a bit of a game." And I knew that Eloise, would be up for it. But I also knew that if you start pegging an 11-year-old girl, you've got to get the chaperone out of the room. Because they'd stop it, because it's going to get uncomfortable, or it's going to hit that interesting line. So I had to have a chat with the producer and say, look, I wonder if there's any way you can just contrive to make sure the chaperone isn't in the room for the moment. I won't do anything mad, but I just want to give Bill a bit of freedom. And they really went for it, and he pegged Eloise on the ears, on the nose, and everywhere, and she was, tears were running down her face because it was uncomfortable, but she was screaming with laughter. And it's just, you can't buy that. You certainly can't rehearse it. So in that sense, in a way, it's just fitting that flexibility and responsiveness to the form. In terms of collaboration, it's completely different. It's a much lonelier job. You've got, your key producer is with you all the way through, and that's your sort of main pal. And I've been lucky in that all the work I've done, I've had in Dixie Linda, the wonderful partner in that. But first you're working with the writer, of course, and that's a very strong, that's the sort of foundation of it. But Marco Rowe, who wrote Broken, he didn't come on set once. Alecky Blythe and Adam Cork were on set all the time for London Road, but Mark was like, no, it's your job now. You take it and we've done our work. So then the relationship becomes, the key relationship shifts to the first AD, then the DOP, and then you're moving into the editor, and then you're going into all the post work. The DOP comes back a little bit, by which time they might have shot another three films. Who knows? And the actors in the middle of it, which is where obviously a lot of the that's where the crucial stuff happens. Have you when you literally do you get it in the can or don't you? So there's a series of really primary and very creative collaborations that happen, but they're all strung out. You don't have that sense of everybody pulling together, everybody being in the same boat, rowing hard towards press night in theatre. Consequently, you've got you. I remember on my first film, on Broken, at the beginning, somebody said. One of the, and there's a whole swathe of brilliant people that you work with around a film set. But one of them said that this will be pressure like you've never known it in theatre. So hold on to your hat. And actually, that wasn't the case, because the pressure building to press night, when you know that that everything depends on a handful of people who are coming to see the work and all the trials and tribulations that you've had up to that point don't matter. There's nothing that can get you out of this. You've just got to sit back, hand it over to the cast and the stage management, and hope that they do their job. And that's horrible. And the judgment that comes from it can be horrible. In film, it's sort of like a mini version of that every day. And so this question of making the day is really key. And there are days on both films where the weather's against you, or something goes wrong, or you get behind on something, and you can't ask the crew to stay over. It doesn't work like that. I mean, that's one thing that's different in theatre. You do have a kind of family, which you can lean on and abuse to a certain extent. And in film, you don't have the time or opportunity to make those deep relationships. So certainly not in the way that I did it. Perhaps, if that's what I was doing full time for years and years, you build that up. So it's very different.
Is the rehearsal process similar at all?
But you've got 5 or 6 weeks, 4 weeks, whatever it is, within a way, a building pressure, but no, the first period of that doesn't have that drive in the clock isn't ticking as hard. So you've got much more time and space to really get lost in something and build it up. And if one day you don't achieve everything that you set out to do, or you come up against a block and it needs a rewrite, or an actor's finding a particular aspect challenging, or whatever it is, or you've got illness. Tomorrow is another day, and you can start afresh. On film, you've got today, and that's it. When you're shooting.
Taking a turn back to the national, I remember Lynette Linton talking about when she was running The Bush that as much as running a building is about sort of deciding artistic direction and how to sort of improve, say, diversity on stage or the kind of stories you want to tell, it's equally about the toilets are broken, we need someone to fix it, and there aren't enough lemons for the drinks, and you need to solve that. What was something about the sort of the day-to-day running of something like the National Theatre that you didn't expect, but surprised you when you were doing?
Wow. I almost can't speak for the number of things in my head.
Sure.
In a way, it's what it's not very clever to go from, I did run a fringe theatre many, many years ago for a short while. But if you look at the progress of many artistic directors, they do the sensible thing, which certainly applied to my theatre directing career of going, work in a small scale, work in a slightly larger and build up, to go from a sort of standing start to the national. Albeit that I had by then worked in many theatres of all scales and had pretty good insight into the Royal Court to an extent, the Young Vic, and also the National, because I was an associate for Nick. There's no prep for it really. You just have to launch in. I knew, of course, that it's a cliche to expect the unexpected, that there would be, it would not stop, and there would be, and I'd be meeting new things all the time. Maybe, in the end, maybe the most important thing is what you come up against in yourself. I can talk about, okay, I didn't, I suppose I didn't think I'd be getting as involved as I did in fundraising, or the complexities of HR, the degree to which the program moves around a bit, the ways in which you have to make your core principles manifest in sort of everything that you're trying to do there, and the complexities of that. And then, of course, we got hit with COVID and the very profound implications of George Floyd and that movement. But really, the big tests are you, how you deal with having to every day stand up and make decisions and take the rap, and be the place where the buck stops, how you have to turn up, when inside you're riddled with imposter syndrome and self-doubt and doubt about what decision is the right decision. In a way, it is, the reason that artistic directors generally are directors is that there is a parallel. You do have to make decisions and keep everybody with you, and even if you don't keep them with you, you've still got to make the decisions and go, right, this is what we're doing. People need clarity more than anything, particularly when you're in a crisis. And the way that an organization like that keeps going is through decisions being made. There was one quite pivotal point early on where there'd been a lot of trouble at the top of the organization, which had been all-consuming and really difficult on that personal level as well as the organizationally. And I remember going into the photocopying room and bumping into Paul Hanley, who's the technical director, and saying, "How you doing, Paul? How are the gang? How the technical crew's getting on? Bearing in mind the turmoil that's been going on at the top of the organization." And he looked at me and said, "Oh, they couldn't give a toss. They're too busy." It's great. It was like, okay, what they need is to know what is happening in the Dorfman in January. They don't need to know. They're not interested in, the conversations between the board and the executive about this, that, and the other. They need to know what they need to build today. So that they don't get into a massive log jam in 3 months' time, which they can see coming and which they're shouting at you is coming, and will have a profound impact on the finances, the morale, and the delivery of the shows. And in the end, we're only there for the shows. So, sorry, I'm getting off the point. It's really about yourself. How what you do, the biggest unexpected is those profound things in your character, or flaws or insecurities or overconfidences that you bump up against and have to resolve or get round or deal with quickly.
It's remarkable how you can be sort of CEO and running such a complex organization and then also direct shows within it simultaneously. How involved are you when others come in to direct? Because during your tenure, you had Rupert Gould doing Dear England and Sam Mendes doing Motor from the Q and Indy Rubensingham doing Fathering the Assassin and so many more. How involved are you when others come in to direct in terms of I used to be a primary school teacher, and I kind of view it in the terms of like a head teacher. Are you coming in to sort of observe lessons going on, or are you just sort of, they know what they're doing, I'll see it at press night? What is the.
Well, I think in a way it's, the great thing about working with actors, there are many great things about working with actors, but one of the great things is that they're all completely different. In your podcast with Simon, he talks very eloquently, Simon McBurney, he talks very eloquently about actors being deeply instinctive with quite a secretive process, a lot of them. And I think that's true. And because it's personal, they all work in very, very different ways. So part of running a kind of collaborative and successful rehearsal room is, for me anyway, is making sure that you are respectful of that and that you can flex how you work depending on what that actor needs to get the best out of them. And if you extrapolate that out to a whole program and how you work with directors. And writers, I would say, the majority of the work that we did over the last 10 years at the National was new writing with the writer in the room and the predominance of the National Theatre Studio and that dramaturgical team has really risen during that time. So a lot of the work is about what happens before they get into rehearsals in that sense. But I think it's bespoke. I think it's completely bespoke. With somebody like Sam Mendes, the most important thing is getting him to do his show at the National Theatre.
Sure.
I don't want to blow too much smoke, but it's going to be fine.
Sure.
And even to an extent, it's not that it doesn't matter what the play is. The important thing is that it's what he wants to do. So when he said, "Look, I've got this idea, this Mazzini thing, and da, 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 it might have 50 people in it, or it might be a one-person show, don't know, but I'm interested in it," you get behind it. If Sam's digging a hole, get in, pick up the spade, and get digging alongside him. So what does you know? So what does Sam need? Sam needs you to say yes. Come on board, and. Go get involved. There'll be one or two crucial conversations along the way, but mostly it's about kind of clearing the path. When you're really trying to expand the breadth of people that are working in a place like the National, that is one end of the spectrum. Working with Roy Alexander Wise on a Natasha Gordon play when they're both, it's Natasha's first play and Roy has done a few shows but not many. That's a very, very different degree of support. And I think it took me a long time to appreciate that and. If someone were to ask me what are my top five mistakes in my time at the National, four of them would be, the times where I did not support the director in the way that the director needed support. I'm not going to name them, They probably know who they are if they ever listen to this. And I deeply regret that because it has a profound impact on their process. Sometimes, sometimes you can be really hands off, and sometimes you need to be there more directly, but never in a way which is which has a sense of, it's sort of never in the room. It's always outside the room, really. Once you start turning up in somebody else's rehearsal room, it's all weird. Quite early on, I would, I would say, some directors go, come see the final run through, or come see me at lunchtime. I don't want you in the rehearsal room otherwise. And some go, no, it's an open room. And often when they say it's an open room, they really don't mean it. And learning to read that was something I think they sort of almost always don't mean it. A couple of times I went in, and it gets weird quite quickly. You just have to get out of there. It's not your room. You've trusted them to take the job, so trust them to do it. Yeah, it's a fascinating alchemy. But obviously, the most important thing to do is to support them to do their job. Trust them.
Yeah, and sort of clear the obstacles they might face
Yeah,
to allow them.
and trying to predict where those obstacles might be, and it could be that it's to do with their communication with the around marketing, or it could be that it's because they need a bit of support in a field trip that they want to do, or actually they just want to. Or in extremis, they might need to tell you that they're going to, it's really likely that in week two they'll come off the job and you'll have to take over. And you have that conversation, and in the back of your head, you're thinking, is this real, or is this what you need to do to get through the next week? And usually it's the latter. That's quite an extreme case. With someone like Rupert, it's Rupert and I have known each other for most of our careers, and I think and hope have from a distance have looked over the fence with some mutual respect. Getting Dear England, I tried for many years to get Rupert to come and do a show during my tenure there. We finally managed it, and lo and behold, it worked out very well. So it was good that we took the time that we did, but that one took a long time. And the first time that James and Rupert came to talk to Ben Power and I about Dear England was probably 4 years before it became manifest. And James Graham is brilliant. Everybody knows that. But he's a bugger, and he and getting him to actually put the stuff down needs a James wrangler, and Rupert is a great James wrangler. So how to and it's a complicated one, but how to support that process to give them what they need, and allow the timelines to slip, but not slip too far. And when the point is to go, right, no, we're doing it then. And knowing how busy both of them are, and how to tie that down, that's something that I think I hope I got better at over the decade. I certainly made some mistakes early on, which I wouldn't make again.
It certainly seems as much about diplomacy as it is sort of artistic creativity or and sort of management of people.
I think management is creative, and that's why a place like the National is stuffed full of artists. And it's not just when people say, we sort of banned the phrase, when people talk about the creatives, that's a really rubbish phrase. There's nothing uncreative about the development department and how those brilliant people work out how to do things. And I would say the same in people, or in the the skill. One of the great joys for me in my last months was spending a week on the floor in the carpentry workshop and just understanding what, they're artists, they're artisans, they're craftspeople, but they're also those chippies that have been in that room since it was built. They have great artistry in them as well. So if you once you start thinking about it in that way, how you manage, it's all bespoke.
Yeah, no, totally. Was there such a thing as an average day? Was there such a thing as like, oh, this is a typical Tuesday, this is a typical Thursday?
Well, I don't know. Yes, but typical in its untypicality, if that's a word. The first thing that I did, not the first, one of the first things that I did when I moved into the office, the sort of director's office, which I shared with Lisa Berger, was to have windows put in the door and the two doors. There's two doors to that office, and also to get windows put into any doors down the corridors on the fourth and fifth floor, which is because of the way the National's built. All the offices are along two long corridors. It's not ideal for communication, and many of the doors didn't have windows in them, which means that the challenge, the endless challenge of not of helping people to not get siloed, was made more manifest. So putting windows in felt like a really good idea. On a typical day, on a typical Tuesday, there would be, and I was in the office some of the time. Some of the time, I was. This is outside of rehearsal. I'd be elsewhere in the design studio or different parts around the building. But when I was in the office, a typical Tuesday would have a moment where a figure would appear hovering behind one of those windows, and that's the moment where you go, okay, now whatever I'm doing now, that is the signal to say stop what you're doing. Doesn't matter how important it is, because there is the challenge of the day is about to hit you, and you never knew what it was going to be, and so you'd have to say in whatever meeting you're in, I'm really sorry, I just need to deal with something. It that's particularly challenging when you're in rehearsal, when you see the figure, or somebody comes into the rehearsal room when you're in the middle of directing a scene, and it's your EA or even worse, kind of head of department, or even worse, one of the executive. Then you go, oh shit, now something's going on, and many, many times you have to just stop what you're doing and go, right, there's a fire, we've got to put it out. So I'd say a typical day might have lots of meetings in it, some of them creative, some of them less so, some with staff, some with freelancers, some speculative, some absolutely to do with what's going on. That would be a normal day, but there would also be a figure behind the glass at some point.
That's quite a sort of, yes, that sort of looming spectre of something troubles afoot. In the writing of Derry Girls, I remember their name escaped me, but the writer of Derry Girls would describe each episode as having a pickle of the week, and it sounds like that kind of thing of like, oh, this is the thing today, the unexpected thing that will twist it up.
Yeah,
You
the
mentioned.
worst thing, of course, is to get to 6 or 7 o'clock and go, wow, today's been quiet. I never say that.
Then at 6:59. The spectre returns.
Well, yeah.
We mentioned about the carpentry, and I love that you mentioned in a Guardian article about sort of your upcoming leaving of the building that you wanted to do a week sort of apprenticeship in the carpenter's workshop, sort of returning to your roots of sort of carpentry and building and those kind of things. And now obviously you're living in quite remote Scotland. Have you left directing? Or are you returning at any point? And are there, you mentioned at one point, most directors have a bottom drawer full of plays they'd love to have a go at. What's left?
Well, just to deal with that one first, I don't have a bottom drawer. I've never had a bottom drawer, and there's nothing in it. In terms of existing plays, I have lots of pieces of string. that I want to pull on or am pulling on. And some of them will, I would imagine, end up in a theatre. Some of them might, if I'm lucky, end up on screen. And some of them might have nothing to do with those things. It's interesting you say I'm in a remote part of Scotland. I'm not. I'm in a fairly accessible village on the east coast, probably an hour and 10 minutes from Edinburgh. I can come up and down. I'm not up in the depths of the Outer Hebrides. But one of the reasons that I took, what might to some people feel like a really radical decision to properly step away, was to give myself the freedom to actually not make any decisions. Of course, the insecure part of me was going, no, you've got to have lots of things lined up. And I thought, no, the brave thing to do, stepping into that fear again, is to not do any of that, is literally to have nothing. In a pragmatic sense, we downsized significantly to make sure that I could afford to have a few months of not earning any money. My wife's working away. I'm a kept man at the moment, which is lucky for me. But yes, the point was to step away and just give space. One of the, there are many privileges and very kind of rich experiences of running a place like the National Theatre, and being an artistic director. But time for your art is not one of them. I think it's, and I know Rupert spoke about that in his podcast. I think he's managed it better than me. But I think my artistry has certainly not been given this space. It's just not possible, when you're dealing with something like that. So I wanted to have a complete break from responsibility and just see what shoots came up. In answer to, am I gonna direct theatre again? Yeah, I think so. I don't have, there's not very much on the slate. There's a couple of things which are brewing away for next year. I think I'll probably do two or three fairly controlled, not very unepic projects. And at the same time, yeah, I am still leaving myself open to where the wind might blow in other directions. I can't remember the word, but in Hindu culture, there's a moment when you're 60, which is quite pivotal, and there's a whole ritual around it, because this is the moment where you can, I suppose, you can reflect, and you enter a different age where you can move forward, and if it's the right thing to do, make a different set of choices. And I've never done it in my life to actually stop properly, and it just felt really important to do that. And I'm in the middle of it, and it's great. I can get outside every day. I can spend time in nature. I always wanted to be a zoologist when I was young, and it's lovely to refine that a bit. I think I'm too old to completely retrain, but there are some transferable skills. Interested to see how it develops.
Yes, it sounds like a budding was it Lawrence Durrell? Maybe a revival of the Durrells. Maybe that's on the a combination.
My family and other animals. Actually, I haven't thought about that for decades. That was quite a pivotal book for me when I was young.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and it sort of sums up my, I suppose, my life, my family, and other animals. Yeah, brilliant.
I've two questions to end this on. One is you very kindly asked for were there any questions for you to prep on before we did the podcast? And so I'd be remiss if I didn't actually ask you it, which is what is the best advice and what is the worst advice you've ever received?
I suppose the worst advice was from a drama teacher when I was 16, I think, maybe 15, 15 into 16. I was in a big comprehensive outside Birmingham, and she didn't like me. I never really understood why. I don't think I gave her cause, but she really didn't. And she said, you are not clever enough to go to university, and you're certainly not talented enough to go to drama school. So you need to really be thinking about something else for your future life. It is the worst advice in one way, but also I do have something to thank her for because I knew she was wrong. I had no idea whether I could get into drama school, but I knew that I could go to university if I put my mind to it. And it galvanized me. I thought, oh, fuck you, properly. And in terms of getting right back to the beginning of the conversation, that sense of, weebles wobble, don't fall down. That was quite a thing to be told by a teacher when you're sort of 15 or 16. But I did. I just thought, you're wrong. I know you're wrong. And so I'm going to do what I feel like doing, and we'll see where it goes. So that's probably the worst. The best. I was kind of stuck on this because there are two, but I think probably this was advice that was not given to me actually, but I was present when it happened. As I said, I grew up all over the world. And when we grew up and got into our, sort of late teens, early 20s, we by which I mean my siblings and I all started traveling in our different ways. And various of us went off and lived in different places or worked in different places, and kind of have done in different ways through our lives. And one of my sisters, was joining VSO, Volunteer Services Overseas, and had been asked about whether there was a region of the world that she would favour going to. And she had a conversation with my dad about it. My dad was very well travelled and quite wise about these things. And he said it doesn't really matter where you go. There are kind of dangers and some things are more or less likely, comfort and different environments, obviously, the cultures that you'd be going into, the belief systems, all the rest of it. But if you're sensible, you might pick up the odd bout of malaria, but unless you're unlucky, you'll be fine. Unless there's chaos. So I would advise you to avoid chaos. And in that instance, he was basically saying, don't go to the Congo, on that list. But I heard it and I thought that's great. And it goes back to your question about stepping into fear. If I'm going to go out on my kayak this afternoon, I will look at the sea. I will look at the weather forecast. I will know where the tide is, and I will put on a spray deck. And I have done the training to work out what happens if I can't roll back, to make sure that the worst case will be that I get wet. And then I do some damage to a piece of equipment, but not to myself. Some people would say, "What are you doing, age 60, going into the North Sea in November or December?" I go, "Well, no, that's fine. If you've done a bit of prep, then I'll get the rush. I'll feel the adrenaline. I'll get that state of fear, but I won't be in chaos." So there's a real limit to the amount of fear you want to put yourself into. And I think that's probably the best bit of advice that I've had.
That's brilliant advice, and one that I'll follow as I move forward. I hope the training is good. Please don't let this be the last interview you do because you go out on a kayak in December.
No, it will be fine. My self-preservation instincts are quite healthy.
Excellent. My final question is one I ask everyone on the show, which is why do we need stories?
Well, now, I think, I mean, there's all the obvious kind of generic answers about the ability to stand in other people's shoes, or a way of understanding the world, or a way of understanding worlds that are not our world. I'm sort of interested in the moment in I've been doing a little reading about it. The progression of story, which started more as a kind of record of what happened, or what happens. I won't get this right, but the chronicle, which doesn't have a moral in it, and it doesn't have a beginning, middle, and end as such. It's just a record of events. From ages where it sort of wasn't necessary because the defining story was set, that being religious, or ecclesiastical, depending on which culture you grew up in. And as we've gone into, I suppose, from the time when people started to pay for to see stories. And bearing in mind that in Greek times, where the morality of or the stories that were set were set by the people who'd paid for the theatre and then paid for people to go, it was in some Attic drama it was compulsory to go to the theatre. It was part of your education, and it certainly wasn't something that you paid for. Once people started paying, they started demanding more of it, and so entertainment comes into it, and consequently it gets a bit more secular, or it could be a bit more provocative, and the moral or the morality of it, as dramatic structure forms, becomes more embedded in what's going on. And so I think the personal then becomes becomes more important, where who wins, who loses, what they are cautionary to, it remains cautionary, but perhaps with less overt sort of right and wrong, becomes more complex. And that's necessary because the world is much more complex now. I still think that the same probably applies. It is the mechanism, and has been as long as humans have stood up, by which we can best understand the experience of someone else, and therefore you can map your own story onto the story that's being told.
Beautiful. Rufus, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Pleasure. I feel like a, you know, well. Who knows? You just got to take the Daldry note, let the inhibition go, and just chat. Hopefully, there's enough there for you to pick and choose a few bits from. But also, thank you, Dom. It's great the amount of research you do, and some lovely, surprising, and quite some good mining there. I suppose I expected you to ask a bit more about the kind of pragmatics of the last 10 years, and it's all much more profound than that, which is very welcome. So thank you.